Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, going in-depth with the most interesting innovators, changemakers, business leaders, politicians, and activists in Vermont and around the country.
This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Lake Champlain Transportation, a community leader pioneering new paths in business. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. And by Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And it's made possible by over 1,000 VBSR members.
Here is noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Our topic this week is war, peace, spying, and the media. Our guests are two journalists who have been on the cutting edge on reporting on these issues. In the second half hour today, we'll be talking with Jeremy Scahill, author of a new book and subject of a new movie, Dirty Wars. In our first half hour, we'll be talking with Chris Hedges. Hedges spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. He's reported from more than 50 countries and has worked for the Christian Science Monitor, NPR, the Dallas Morning News, and the New York Times, where he was a foreign correspondent for 15 years. Hedges was also part of the team of reporters at the Times who was awarded a Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for the paper's coverage of global terrorism. But soon after the 9/11 attacks, Hedges grew disillusioned and left the New York Times. Chris Hedges, I'm going to welcome you to the Vermont Conversation. I'm going to let you pick up the story from there. And I should say, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you.
Chris, just retrace. You were on briefly in September, and we promised to get you back now. Retrace briefly the odyssey that resulted in you leaving the New York Times after 15 years, shortly after 9/11 attacks.
I had been overseas for the Times. I had been the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, and I had spent a total of 7 years in the Middle East, and I speak Arabic. Much of my time was spent in Iraq, and I had written a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which came out right after the 9/11 attacks, in the months that the Bush administration, when they were drumming up support for an invasion of Iraq, I, because of the book, would be on shows like Charlie Rose and others and would inevitably be asked about the call to invade Iraq, which I think most Arabists, whether they were in the State Department, the intelligence community, the Pentagon, thought to be utterly foolish for all the reasons we now know. I mean, foolish is, in fact, of course, tragic and awful. But to say that in the climate after 9/11, despite the fact that it wasn't an opinion so much as it was based on long experience in the region, including in Iraq itself, was unpalatable, and I was booed off of a commencement stage in 2003 at Rockford College, which is on YouTube, and the right-wing trash talk cable news shows got a hold of it and lynched me in the same way they just run a kind of 30-second clip hour after hour and denounce you, and pressured the Times to respond, and the Times responded by issuing me a formal written reprimand, which is what you give Guild employees under the contract before you're allowed to fire them. So the choice was that I muzzle myself and fealty to my career, which I wasn't about to do, or I leave the paper, and I left the paper.
What changed for you? I mean, as somebody covering wars, and I certainly remember your byline in the Times as a war correspondent, it was not new to you to have to report in very neutral tones on some, really both horrific conflicts and horrific politics that lay behind them. What changed for you after 9/11 that you felt you had to go public with your, you know, your feelings about this.
In fact, nothing changed. What I did as a reporter, and you're right that the, you know, the style of American journalism is very circumscribed, but what I did is put myself in positions or in locations where people were enduring tremendous suffering, whether that was in the famine in the Sudan, Gaza. I spent 5 years covering the war in El Salvador and the Contra war in Nicaragua. And by getting out in the field and reporting factually what had happened, the atrocities that had taken place, whether that was being carried out by the death squads in El Salvador, the Contras, or the Israelis in Gaza, was for me the only kind of journalism I was interested in practicing. I didn't want to cover the Pentagon. I didn't go to Washington. I didn't want to follow around, you know, the Secretary of State or anything like that. And one could speak freely, well, freely, one could speak more openly about what, for instance, the Salvadoran government was doing, or what Slobodan Milosevic was doing in Yugoslavia. I went on and covered the war in Bosnia and Kosovo. But to come back to the United States, which I did right before 9/11, and to speak as candidly about what our own government was doing was prohibited. And I think that there's a kind of a narrowing of possibilities. The further you are from the centers of power as a reporter, the more honestly you can speak, the closer you get. I mean, once you're in the corridors of Washington, or once you attempt to be open about and honest about what your own government is doing, then you get into trouble. And so it wasn't so much of a change. It was, you know, a kind of response that, you know, I mean, if I went on Fresh Air or something and talked about Kosovo, I didn't necessarily feel I had to pull my punches about the Serbs. But when you start talking about your own government and criticizing power in your own country, then your latitude is curtailed tremendously. And that's really the kind of train wreck that I ran into.
You have of late been writing books, and you have a weekly column on truthdig.com. One of the topics you took on recently kind of pulls together two different hats you've worn. You have a column earlier this month on the radical Christian right and the war on government, and it was looking at some of the issues that underlay the government shutdown. You hold a master's degree from Harvard Divinity School, and you spent 2 years investigating the religious right for your book, American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. Talk about the role of religion in your life and work, and what and how you see that thread continuing in the what we've seen this last month with Ted Cruz and the shutdown.
Well, it's interesting that Jeremy's going to follow me, because, of course, he spent time at the Catholic Worker, and that is pretty close to the rule of on Protestant, the religious tradition I come out of, which is that kind of Christian anarchism, left-wing movement embodied in figures like Dorothy Day. My father was a minister. My mother was a seminary graduate. First church was in Barnett Center, Vermont. I was born in St. Johnsbury. And
didn't know you had a Vermont connection.
I'm a native. And so that tradition is one that I honor. I'm not in an institutional sense particularly religious, but I deeply respect that tradition. And I had, when I was a seminarian at Harvard Divinity School, and I had studied with a great scholar, James Luther Adams, whose formative experience in life was being in Nazi Germany in 1935 and 1936, and he had watched the academic elite, including most theologians, line up behind the Nazi Party. He had started work with the underground so-called Confessing Church, Bonhoeffer, Niemöller, Karl Barth, Schweitzer, until he was picked up by the Gestapo and expelled from the country. And he told us, and this was in the early 80s, that when we were his age, he was then 80, we would all be fighting the Christian fascists in the United States. And he said that because he saw the twin phenomena of the Weimarization of the American working class, the destruction of the American working class, coupled with the rise of a religious movement that fused the iconography and language of American nationalism with the Christian religion, which is, of course, just what the pro-Nazi so-called German Christian Church did. And although Adams was certainly one of the most brilliant scholars I ever studied with, even then we all sort of rolled our eyes. Well, I leave the country and come back two decades later, and this movement, which was hardly noticed on the fringes of society, is migrated to the centers of power. Indeed, Cruz comes out of that movement. His father is one of the leaders of the movement.
We're talking about Senator Ted Cruz,
right,
from Texas.
And they have a very peculiar ideology, which is one that seeks to reduce, in the name of biblical law — we can talk about all the ways they distort the Bible, which are many — to the protection of property rights and internal and external security and nothing else, that education, charity, everything is supposed to be turned over to the church, or certainly to their brand of the church. And I set out to write this book, as you pointed out, where I spent tremendous amounts of time in mega churches, creationist seminars, pro-life weekends, and came away, you know, in some ways, I it was new to me, because although I had a religious upbringing and religious training, theological training, the evangelical or the Christian right was not a phenomena that I had come out over, that I was familiar with. I went into it with a kind of prejudice about the movement, and spending that length of time with people within the movement, I came to have a great deal of empathy for the despair and struggles and financial dislocations and alcoholism and substance abuse and domestic violence and sexual violence, and really saw that for most of these people, the real world, because of course they retreat into a world of magic, had failed them. And I think much of their lust for apocalyptic violence is about destroying the world that almost destroyed them. And you can't argue rationally with people who think that Adam and Eve were real people putting saddles on dinosaurs. The only thing you can do is reintegrate them back into the economy. And all of the great writers on totalitarianism, whether it's Hannah Arendt, Karl Popper, Fritz Stern and the Politics of Cultural Despair, Paxton and his book The Anatomy of Fascism, root the rise of these movements to a profound despair. And I think that these movements, I took some heat for using the word fascist, but I think they are, as far as we can define fascism, they are fascist movements. And certainly the structure of a megachurch is fascist, male, you almost always invariably white, in direct contact with God, cannot be questioned. You have within these mega churches or these organizations what Hannah Arendt said was common to all totalitarian structures, and that is its public face, which is propaganda, and its internal operation, which is indoctrination. So you suck people into the services, you proselytize, they feel good and warm and loved in a community, and then you immediately start swallowing all of their educational time, religious time, leisure time. You break them from family members who are not born again. and you throw them off balance. And in the course of it, you know, especially being in these prayer groups where people are weeping for unsaved husbands or sons or daughters, it has a frightening kind of cult-like quality to it. And if you go back and read Margaret Singer's Cults in Our Midst, you'll see that these organizations replicate many of the tactics. There's a whole chapter in there on conversion, which I took a course with D. James Kennedy down in Florida. They replicate that. And I think that the failure of the liberal church is that they didn't call these people out. You don't have to graduate from Harvard Divinity School, as I did, to realize that Jesus did not come to make you rich, nor would Jesus being blessing the dropping of iron fragmentation bombs all over the Middle East. And yet the mainstream church didn't have the stomach to denounce these people for who they were, which is Christian heretics. And they gave them a kind of credibility. And my 2 years with them, I walked away with a tremendous amount of empathy for the pain. I think the movement's very frightening, of those who are sucked into it, and a great hatred for the leadership that very astutely knows how to manipulate that despair, not only to push through a very frightening, you know, quasi-Christian fascist ideology and political agenda, but also for personal enrichment. These people are incredibly wealthy. Figures like Pat Robertson, his personal worth is somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion. Olstein, all of them.
Let me just interrupt here. We're talking this week with Chris Hedges, a former war correspondent, author, and now columnist for TruthDig.com. You can join the conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Chris, where you're leaving off there, the reality, you know, essentially mimicking the inequality we see in society within these churches where you have these fabulously rich leadership and, you know, a congregation that is considerably different looking, often working class, often struggling. It's a hallmark of our politics today, and I wonder what insight you can offer on this. How do you get people to vote and act against their own class interest, as we've been seeing both during and after the shutdown, where you have senators from states with some of the leading percentages of their population on Medicaid and Medicare, and they are the ones voting to slash Medicaid, Medicare, and food stamps? What insight do you have on how that happens? How do you get people to vote against themselves?
Well, first of all, I don't think if you vote for the Democratic Party, you vote for your own interests. The Democratic Party is beholden to corporate power, Wall Street, the fossil fuel industry, not to mention the national security and surveillance state as the Republicans. You know, starting with Clinton, the Democratic Party turned their back on working men and women in this country. And that fundamentally is the problem. They pay lip service, unlike the Republican Party, to those values, but they no longer protect the constituency that at one time the liberal wing of the Democratic Party did protect. There is no liberal wing of the Democratic Party. In fact, the Democratic Party, if it was in Europe, would be considered a far-right party. What happens is that when people are cornered, and this goes back to the book on the Christian right, they retreat into a world of magic. If you really truly believe that Jesus will cure your cancer, then you don't need health care, which is why a lot of these big corporations like Walmart and others allow these pastors to walk into their warehouses and carry out this kind of proselytization. I mean, I teach in a prison, and the evangelicals are all over it because the message is, you know, there's nothing wrong with society. There's just something wrong with you. And once you accept magic Jesus into your heart, he'll take care of you. And when you have nothing else, that is a very attractive and appealing ideology. And I think that what we're seeing with the rise of this lunatic fringe, not only within the Republican Party, but embodied in the Tea Party and militias and the Christian right and others, is exactly the kind of frightening totalitarianism that James Luther Adams warned us about. When you reconfigure your society into a kind of neo-feudal state. I mean, half of this country lives in poverty, and you offer them no way out, then this is the natural kind of consequence. People embrace these kinds of belief systems, and you know, not only are they in the end not voting in their own interest, they're voting for their own enslavement. And that's the battle that's really underway. And I think that when I covered the breakdown of Yugoslavia, it was a very similar kind of scenario where you had the economic collapse of Yugoslavia and an ineffectual and weak self-identified liberal center, that would be figures like Obama, who actually don't either have the will or the power to respond to the grievances and injustices and suffering of the masses. And with that, I mean, all of these movements need a crisis to come to power, but with the hyperinflation in Yugoslavia, people turned in fury on that center, which ruled Yugoslavia. And the danger in those kinds of situations is that not only do they eject the self-identified liberals, but they the purported liberal values that these people espouse are utterly discredited. Everyone knew, for instance, that Radovan Karadzic in Sarajevo was insane, and yet the anger at the system made them turn to these figures that are always vomited up in times of turmoil and crisis. And that's what I find so frightening. And much of my opposition to the Obama administration, to the Democratic Party, comes out of this historical awareness, indeed personal experience in Yugoslavia, if we don't build mass movements and third-party movements, and I was Ralph Nader's speechwriter in 2008, then in a moment of crisis, everything that we care about, which is a liberal, nonviolent, democratic society, is wiped out. And let's not forget that American society is a deeply violent society. The undercurrent of violence, just look at the gun shooting statistics. And these movements on, whether it's the Christian right or whether it's the Tea Party, I mean, there's a whole sort of collection of them, but they come out of the same ideological formation. They celebrate the gun culture. They talk in the language of violence. They sacralize the nation. And they do what fascist movements do, which is blame the problems on the vulnerable, whether that's undocumented workers or Muslims or homosexuals, feminists, intellectuals. They have a long list of people they despise, and I've seen it before. And so the inability on the part of the liberal elite, the liberal democratic elite, to defy the Democrats essentially makes them complicit. And, I mean, we saw it with the rise of the Occupy movement, shut down by the Obama administration. All of the grievances that pushed those people into that movement are still there and getting worse. The failure to extend unemployment benefits, nothing done on the foreclosure and a mortgage crisis, student debt at $1 trillion. And we now, thanks to the Congress, not only can you never get out of it, even if you declare bankruptcy, but the rates are going to go up. So these kids are saddled with huge debt peonage, which they can never get out of because they can't get decent jobs.
So, Chris,
on long-term unemployment and underemployment.
What is the way forward? Where do you see the hope in this morass?
Rebuilding mass movements, which were all just, we used to have them in this country, and they were all destroyed in the name of anti-communism. But if we don't rebuild those mass movements fast, there will be a backlash. But the only people who are organized are these very frightening movements on the far right. And, of course, they have money from the most retrograde elements of American capitalism, from the Koch brothers and others. And so that was why I was so supportive of the Occupy movement and why I don't particularly think we should waste our time, appealing to Barack Obama or Nancy Pelosi or anyone in the Democratic Party. I mean, just as a journalist, the assault on civil liberties under the Obama administration is far more egregious than it was under the Bush administration.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Chris Hedges, thanks so much for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you.
With so many Medicare drug discount card options, making the right choice is a little overwhelming. That's why you should stop by your local medicine shop pharmacy, 20 South Main Street in Barrie. Our knowledgeable pharmacists will walk you through the plans. They'll find the one that meets your needs and, most importantly, saves you money. When you have a trusted medicine shop pharmacist at your disposal, you can make confident decisions about your health care. Treat your health and your budget. Learn more about Medicare drug discount cards from medicine shop pharmacists today at 20 South Main Street in Barrie.
We can feel quite small in this world and the issues so big. It's easy to forget that there are other people who need our help. What can one person do? Giving to United Way keeps great programs running in our community. Talk to your friends, your family, your coworkers. Talk about issues concerning education, income, and health. Volunteer. We can help connect you with wonderful opportunities right here that fit your skills, your passions, and your time. Contact United Way to find out what you can do. 888-3252.
I'm Tim McGuire. In her opening statement to the House Energy and Commerce Committee, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius said she is sorry for the terrible rollout of the government's health care website.
You deserve better. I apologize. I'm accountable to you for fixing these problems.
Sebelius faced an onslaught of questions about President Obama's health care overhaul. Michigan Republican Congressman Mike Rogers refers to an internal memo from officials at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services expressing their concerns that a lack of testing posed a potentially high security risk for the website.
You accepted a risk on behalf of every user of this computer that put their personal financial information at risk because you did not even have the most basic end-to-end test on security of this system.
Sebelius promises that the problems will be fixed by November 30th. AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire.
Looking for a loan for your Vermont business, childcare, or nonprofit organization? Look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Because at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we lend to Vermont businesses and nonprofits, even if the bank says you're not quite ready for a loan. At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we focus on people, not profits. We'll work closely with you before and after you get your loan to make sure you get what you need to succeed. The Vermont Community Loan Fund makes loans to early stage companies and established businesses ready to take the next step. We lend to farms and food producers, high-tech businesses, manufacturers, retailers, childcare businesses, affordable housing developers, service providers, and other nonprofit organizations. We make loans to Vermonters doing business right here at home and around the world. So if you're looking for financing to help your growing business, look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Visit us online at investinvermont.org. That's investinvermont.org.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is pleased to make the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available.
This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Lake Champlain Transportation, a community leader pioneering new paths in business. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. And by Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And it's made possible by over 1,000 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation, and this week's conversation focusing on war, peace, and the media. Our guest in our second half hour is a journalist who is one of the people I admire most in the journalism world, one of the great truth tellers of our time. Jeremy Scahill is a national security correspondent for The Nation magazine and the author of New York Times best-selling book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. And lately, a new book, Dirty Wars, which is also now a movie. Scahill's work has sparked several congressional investigations, and he's won some of journalism's highest honors, twice awarded the prestigious George Polk Award in 1998 with my sister Amy for foreign reporting, and in 2008 for his book Blackwater. Jeremy, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
David, it's great to be with you.
And I gather you are on the road now, touring with both the book and the movie. You're in Santa Fe now?
I am, yeah. I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm doing a series of, I'm talking to some high school students. I'm also giving a lecture at the Lenzic Theater, which is this great historic theater here. And then our film is going to be showing on Thursday. But yeah, I mean, I've been on the road since April when the book first came out, and it's really been amazing to see the kinds of people that come out. I mean, it's not just usual suspects. A lot of military families have come out, and a lot of veterans, and it's been really interesting to be engaged in these conversations about the policies that are being enacted in all of our names and with our tax dollars.
Well, let's pick it up right there, and I will say there's been one showing of Dirty Wars in Vermont. It was sold out. I got to see the movie then. It is really a sensational movie, very gripping, and so here's my personal plug. Make sure you come back here with it. So let's talk about Dirty Wars. The war is a battlefield. In the movie and the book, you detail the toll of the U.S. drone war and the campaign of targeted killing and assassinations by the U.S. against, among others, American citizens. So how did you find out about this secret war, and when did it become the focus of your work?
Well, you know, I worked for many, many years with Amy, with your sister, and she really was my journalistic mentor and hero. And, I list Democracy Now! As my university on social media sites because I don't have a college degree. I learned journalism studying at the School of Democracy Now! Basically as like an apprentice. And one of the things that, you know, was really just incredible for me about that early period in the 1990s when I was working at Democracy Now! Is that Amy really believed in sort of baptism by fire and encouraged young journalists to simply do journalism, to go out there and do it and not worry about who's hiring you or giving you assignments, but to follow your own leads. And early on, when I was working with Amy, I had the chance to go to Iraq. And this was during the 90s when Clinton was president and had imposed this horrible regime of economic sanctions on Iraq that killed hundreds of thousands of people through what was pretty clearly economic warfare. And so I cut my teeth as a reporter under the last Democratic president that we had, and so I didn't grow up as a journalist embracing this myth that the Democrats are somehow this dovish alternative to the hawkish Republicans. I saw a sort of continuum of the policy from Democrats to Republicans through my adult lifetime. So when Obama became president, you know, I had spent the 8 years of the Bush administration reporting from Iraq, about Iraq, reporting on the CIA, reporting on mercenary companies, and we knew all of this sort of nefarious activity was happening, the CIA black sites, the torture, et cetera. When Obama came into office, of course, he had campaigned on his pledge to roll back a lot of that stuff. But then what we saw very early on in his administration was that he was escalating the war in Afghanistan and seemed to be empowering some of the more shady forces from the military and the CIA to do aggressive, expanded covert operations and what they call targeted killing operations. I refer to them as assassinations. And so I went early on with Rick Rowley, who's the director of our film, and you know I've worked with him for many years at Democracy Now! And elsewhere. And we basically set out to try to look at a war within the war in Afghanistan, that you have the conventional war with the Marines and, you know, regular troops, and we see that on TV in the form of embedded journalism. But then there was this sort of other war, which was consisted of night raids and drone strikes. And we set out to investigate a series of night raids that had gone wrong and innocent people had been killed. And in the process of investigating those raids, we learned that the people who were doing the raids were not from the official conventional army. They were these elite special operations forces. And in fact, we stumbled upon one raid where we were able to confirm that the men who did the killing, and it was gruesome, they killed a police commander and an Afghan police commander who was working with the U.S. and two pregnant women. And then they covered it up and dug the bullets out of the women's bodies and blamed it on their families and said it was an honor killing. And when we investigated that, we learned that the men who did that raid were from an entity called the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC, which is this elite secretive force that basically is like a paramilitary wing of the White House and has been around since 1980, but its existence had been classified. So once we realized that this force did it, we started investigating them, and what started off as a journalism project about Afghanistan's two wars, the public and the secret, became a global investigation into this elite secretive force that answers directly to the president.
This is often touted as a clean war, one that, particularly with drones, doesn't involve troops on the ground. What's the reality on the ground that you've found in the places that you've investigated, for example, in Yemen?
Well, you know, when Obama came into office, Yemen had only been hit once in a military strike by the U.S., and that was in November of 2002. George Bush authorized a targeted drone strike against a suspected al-Qaeda leader, and in that strike they killed six people, among them an American citizen named Kamal Darwish, who was from New York State. And he was not supposedly the intended target of the strike, but he was killed in that strike. And from 2002 until 2009, there were no other U.S. Overt U.S. military actions or strikes of that nature. Obama comes into office and is basically briefed by the most powerful figures in the U.S. military, Admiral William McRaven, who at the time was the commander of JSOC. He now has been promoted by Obama to run all special operations forces around the globe. David Petraeus, who, you know, was Cheney's general and a very powerful, influential figure. And then General Stanley McChrystal, who had been JSOC's commander throughout the Bush era and was eventually tapped by Obama to run the war in Afghanistan. And these guys say to Obama, if you don't expand our authorities to hit in a variety of countries around the world, we're going to get hit again inside the United States. And they basically convince Obama that he needs to start authorizing intensified strikes in Yemen. In December of 2009, Obama initiates a bombing campaign in Yemen. They wanted to do a drone strike against an al-Qaeda suspect, but all of the drones at the time were being used in Pakistan, so they used a cruise missile, and they fire it at this village called Al-Majla, which is in the south of Yemen. And instead of saying this was a U.S. operation, the Yemeni government puts out a press release saying that its forces conducted a successful raid on an al-Qaeda camp and killed 34 al-Qaeda militants and destroyed their facility. The White House then sends a letter of congratulations to the Yemenis, praising them for their action. And it turns out that the whole thing was a fraud, that it was a total unilateral U.S. strike, and that the people that they said were al-Qaeda was actually a very poor Bedouin village, and they killed three dozen women and children in that strike. And the White House has never fully explained how that happened. But that kicked off a period of that we're in to this day of regular drone strikes, cruise missile strikes, and then action by teams of Navy SEALs and other special operations forces inside of Yemen. I mean, Obama is waging a dirty war in Yemen right now and has taken it far beyond the Bush era levels.
How does Obama and the U.S. government justify extrajudicial killings?
Well, look, you know, Obama, as we talk, there are still prisoners at Guantanamo being force-fed. Guantanamo remains open. There are people that have been cleared for release that are just languishing in that gulag. And I think that from Obama's perspective, he campaigned on a pledge to shut down Guantanamo. So he wasn't about to start snatching people and putting them in Guantanamo. He has at times gone the route of prosecuting terrorism suspects in civilian courts. But for the most part, I think Obama's counterterrorism team has adopted the position that the kill capture program should be more heavily weighted in favor of the kill part of it, because they don't want to take prisoners. And I think that they rationalize it by saying, we don't want to send our forces in on the ground to these places. The drone, the blast radius of a Hellfire missile fired from a Predator or Reaper drone is much smaller than that of conventional weapons, and so we're able to do precision strikes. And I think that they've convinced themselves that they've figured out a way to do a cleaner form of warfare. And part of why they believe this, and when Obama says that he, you know, we've only killed a small number of civilians, and it keeps me up at night, you know, even though it's a small number, is because their own mathematical equations for determining who's a civilian and who is a terrorist are such that almost no one is a civilian in the areas where they're bombing in Yemen and Pakistan. They posthumously declare anyone they kill in a drone strike to have been a militant. And so when you set it up in that way, of course you're not killing any civilians, because everyone in Waziristan is a terrorist. And that's literally what they've done. They've classified whole regions of people as terrorists or terrorist facilitators.
Well, one of the other areas that you write about and that we visit in your movie, Dirty Wars, and we're talking here on the Vermont Conversation with journalist Jeremy Scahill, is the country Somalia. And now this is a country with no functioning central government. What brought you there in the context of this investigation? And for starters, what does Mogadishu look like today?
Right. Well, you know, the history of Somalia is almost entirely just blacked out or whited out from, you know, the American classroom. I mean, people grow up in the United States knowing one basic thing about Somalia, or maybe two: Black Hawk Down or starving kids. And yet, when you actually investigate what happened in Somalia, it really was a U.S.-made disaster in many ways.
Well, now we have to add Captain Phillips to that.
Now we have Tom Hanks and the whole. I mean, that film is just pure propaganda. There is so much that happened, and you know, there's such a political context to, you know, what's called piracy off the coast of Somalia that just goes unmentioned in the U.S. press. I mean, part of the rise of piracy on the Somali coast, and Somalia has the largest coastline in all of Africa. And Somalia has a very lucrative pool of natural resources. Many of them are marine resources. I mean, they have, the lobster trade is huge. The tuna trade is huge. And what happened after Somalia imploded in the early 1990s is that major European companies were sending their ships to do illegal fishing off the coast of Somalia. And they were basically just stealing one of Somalia's prime resources and one of its prime exports, and there were also companies that were going into Somalia's water and doing illegal dumping of chemicals. So Somalis started to form their own coast guard, and they would go out and they would board ships and demand that a tariff be paid for passing through Somali waters or for fishing in Somali waters. And eventually that turned into piracy, where it became a totally for-profit thing. But at the beginning, it was a response to actions by primarily European companies and countries to simultaneously steal the fish from Somalia, but also dumping in some parts of the Somali coast waste. And so, you know, there's just a context that often goes missing. But what the point I'm getting at about Somalia is that Somalia never had a significant al-Qaeda presence whatsoever. In fact, Osama bin Laden tried throughout the 90s to figure out a way to get a foothold in Somalia, and the Somali clan-based systems rejected that foreign presence. When the United States and Ethiopia invaded Somalia in 2006-2007, they created such a fierce backlash that Islamic militant organizations, including people from al-Qaeda, were able to sort of pitch themselves as the vanguard against their crusaders trying to take over this Muslim country. And it gave rise to the group Al-Shabaab, which was a nobody organization in Somalia for the entire period leading up to 2006-2007. They were nobodies. And they suddenly become this very powerful force that is fighting for the Somali people. So in a way, Al-Shabaab was a U.S. creation. And of course, for people that don't know, Al-Shabaab was behind this major terrorist attack on the Westgate Shopping Mall in Nairobi, Kenya, a few weeks ago, and has been responsible for bombings, suicide bombings in Kampala, Uganda during the 2010 World Cup. They've regularly done suicide bombings at the gates of the African Union peacekeeping force in Mogadishu, and has pledged its allegiance to al-Qaeda. They would never have become as powerful as they are without U.S. intervention in Somalia.
When you went there, the landscape that we see in the movie of Mogadishu, it looks like as much rubble as there is actual construction. And you're shown, you know, ducking and dodging behind walls just to get from house to house. What was it like, and how risky was that?
It's the most hellish place I've ever seen. You know, the city of Mogadishu is divided into small little kingdoms, basically, that warlords are running. And some of these warlords are on the CIA payroll. Some of them are working for the Eritrean, you know, regime. Some of them are backed by Ethiopia. I mean, there's all these proxy wars going on. So there's just constant gun battles happening. And in the mix of that, you have this multi-thousand African Union peacekeeping force that is bankrolled and armed by the United States. You have a CIA base at the airport, at Aden Ade Airport in Mogadishu, where they're paying Somalis $200 a month to run an outsourced kill-capture program. There's a secret prison in the basement of Somalia's National Security Service that the CIA uses to interrogate people. Renditions continue under Obama. They've snatched people from Kenya and brought them into this prison in Somalia so that the CIA can interrogate them. And you know what Somalia? I mean, Somalia is just it's hell. And children are regularly shot by random bullets that are fired into the air or from a building across the city, and they land and boom, hit a kid in the head. The week after we left Somalia on that trip, when we were shooting for the film, there was a cameraman who was shot and killed in crossfire and died on the spot there. And he was doing something that Rick Rowley, our director, had done every day we were in Somalia, being on the back of a truck with a bunch of militia guys filming the city. I mean, it's horrendous. There's no infrastructure there. There's no hope. And people are young people basically have two options: to basically give up on life or to go be beggars on the street or join one of these militias where they're going to get, paid and they can feel like their life has some meaning.
Were you worried about your own safety? I mean, that seems like a dumb question. But
no, I mean, it's not a dumb question. I mean, to call to call it an airport is sort of a dramatic exaggeration. I mean, it's more like just a plot of cement that you hope the plane lands on, and then you go into this building. And we were chased around in the quote-unquote airport by a guy with a needle, insisting that he needed to vaccinate us or we had to pay him $100. I mean, from the moment we landed, it was like, like hepatitis or worse was like, being threatened. And then, you go out, you leave, you pass through vaguely resembles a customs point, and then there are kidnapping gangs right outside of the door. So, we spent months preparing to go there, and we ended up working with an incredibly amazing Somali guy, but we canceled three or four other plans because when we consulted with friends who work in security or journalists, they said you'll get kidnapped if you do what you're going to do there. So we took months and months. No one would insure our trip in the U.S. We had to go outside of the U.S. to get insurance, to get kidnap and ransom insurance for that trip. And then you're in an environment where there are gangs shooting at each other everywhere. And,
you can actually buy kidnap and ransom insurance for Somalia.
Well, yes, you can. I mean, I actually, in retrospect, I don't think we should have, because the kidnapping gangs are sophisticated, and if they know you have K&R insurance, as it's called, they know how many millions of dollars they can get for you. So in some ways, it might be better to not have that insurance or have that price tag on your head. But, my friend Kanan, this Somali rapper, who's an amazing guy, who's from Mogadishu, he has a lyric in one of his songs where he says, "If I rhymed about my home and got descriptive, it would make 50 Cent look like Limp Bizkit." Meaning that, take any sort of urban, warfare setting in the United States and multiply it by 100 and you have Mogadishu.
You conclude Dirty Wars, and we are talking with journalist Jeremy Scahill today on the Vermont Conversation. You conclude your book Dirty Wars with a question: how does a war like this ever end? You don't answer the question in the book.
I don't, no.
Can you answer it here?
Well, no, because I think that, what I wanted to do in both the film and the book, I mean, they're different creatures in a way. The book, I wanted to really be a resource for people where, I mean, obviously you can read it from start to finish, but I also took great pains to create an extensive index that people could look up different periods in American history from, 9/11 to the present. Try to understand what happened in some of these countries where there's not been a lot of good reporting. But when we were thinking of how to end the film, some people were saying, you should have a call to action, or you should have a list of statistics. And we felt like that would have sort of been arrogant, that, maybe 5 years ago, David, if you and I were talking, I would have pretended that I had an answer to this that was logical or sensible. But I don't see how it ends, short of having an entirely different political system in the U.S. I mean, this may sound like an odd answer to your question, but unless we get big corporate money out of politics in the U.S., we're never going to produce political candidates for any office who stand a chance of winning in the sort of corporatized electoral system of this country, who are not beholden to the interests of huge defense or big pharma or big energy. There's no incentive for any of these representatives to ask serious questions about the perpetual state of war. So, in many ways, you could say, well, Obama should declare an end to the war. The U.S. should back off of the, of its sort of assertion that the world is a battlefield and that it can assassinate its own citizens or other nation's citizens. All of that would be part of the answer. But at the end of the day, and this is true of almost any issue we can talk about in our society, unless we get these huge corporations out of our lives when it comes to politics, I don't think anything will fundamentally change. The war will continue.
Let's talk for a minute about journalists and the remarkable case of Edward Snowden, this contractor for the NSA who leaked internal documents showing that the NSA was involved in widespread illegal domestic spying. But what to me is just as remarkable as Snowden's work is the role played by mainstream journalists. We have David Gregory on Meet the Press accusing Glenn Greenwald, saying to him, quote, "To the extent that you have aided and abetted Snowden even in his current movements, why shouldn't you, Mr. Greenwald, be charged with a crime?" And of course, Glenn Greenwald then reporting for The Guardian, who broke many of the stories. Jeff Toobin, who works for The New Yorker and CNN, describes Snowden as a grandiose narcissist who belongs in prison. And then we also have the case of Michael Grunewald, a senior national correspondent at Time magazine, wrote on Twitter, "I can't wait to write a defense of the drone strike that takes out Julian Assange."
Right.
What accounts for, and what's your own personal experience been of attacks on you as a journalist for breaking the stories that you've broken?
Oh, I mean, you know, it's intense. I mean, I remember, you know, when Obama was first elected and did his whole "we need to look forward, not backwards" on the issue of holding torturers accountable. You know, I was one of the people really pushing for prosecutions of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. And, you know, we knew that wasn't going to happen under Obama, but there was just no effort whatsoever to hold those guys accountable. And people like Chuck Todd, who is David Gregory's colleague at NBC, said that those of us who were calling for prosecutions were engaged in cable catnip, and that basically serious people don't have these kinds of conversations. And, you know, you sort of have this holier-than-thou posture of the corporate media, and the attacks on Glenn Greenwald. I mean, David Gregory should be utterly ashamed of himself. I mean, for Jeffrey Toobin to call Edward Snowden a narcissist, I mean, Jeffrey Toobin is a caviar journalist, and he is a total narcissist. Edward Snowden gave up his entire life. The guy lived in the paradise of Hawaii. He was making a lot of money. You know, he had a girlfriend who he was in love with. He had a totally normal life and could have cruised his way through the American dream. And instead, he chooses to go and have to live in exile. He doesn't have a pleasant life in Moscow. He's basically in hiding. He can't come back to the Western Hemisphere. He'll be kidnapped by the U.S. If he goes to Ecuador or Venezuela and there's a change in government there, you don't think that the U.S. would immediately take custody of him? So, I mean, you know, the facts just give lie to all of these allegations. And for people to call for Glenn Greenwald to be arrested, I mean, I think these people would have been calling for Daniel Ellsberg to get the death penalty. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, that you talk about the Christian right, and it's like everything that they're about is a contradiction of the actual life of Jesus. You know, I mean, Jesus wouldn't have been able to win political office in the United States because the Christian right would have hated him.
So let me ask you about speaking of Glenn Greenwald. The new job or work you'll be taking on, Pierre Omidyar, the founder of eBay, has launched a new media venture that will include Glenn Greenwald, you, Laura Poitras, the filmmaker who works with Glenn. Tell us a little bit about this in the minute or so we have left.
Yeah, I mean, I'm incredibly excited about this. And we just also brought on Dan Frumkin, who used to be at the Washington Post, and Liliana Segura, who was at The Nation, and is a really great criminal justice reporter. And we have a lot of other young, really young, great reporters that we're going to be bringing on in the coming weeks, as well as some veterans. And the idea of it is to create a site that is entirely 100% dedicated to adversarial journalism. You know, Pierre and Glenn and Laura and I have, you know, spent weeks discussing the vision for this, and we're all on the same page. We want to challenge the government's rampant violations of the First and Fourth Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, and to not cozy up to anyone in power, and to do hard-hitting journalism that puts the government on the defensive. And I think, you know, we're all looking at it in the spirit of I.F. Stone, and the spirit of Amy Goodman, and the spirit of Cy Hirsch. And, you know, and I think that we want to build alliances with other media organizations, and we want it to be a place where it's a journalist's outlet.
Okay, Jeremy, we have to end it there. Thanks so much for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
All right, thank you.
You have been listening to the Vermont Conversation with host David Goodman. Tune in next Wednesday when, once again, Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its over 1,000 VBSR members bring you David Goodman with this special program.
This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Lake Champlain Transportation, a community leader pioneering new paths in business. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. And by Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And it's made possible by over 1,000 VBSR members.
Your news. I'm Tim McGuire. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius tells the House Energy